For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Taigen's teachings, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Title of the lecture, playing off another famous koan, does the dog have Buddha nature, is does dim sum have the Buddha nature? And so let's talk for a minute about the significance of dim sum. So if we, you know, if you just think of dim sum and you're explaining that to somebody who has never eaten any Chinese food before, isn't familiar with dim sum, how might we explain briefly what is dim sum? Anybody would like to? Yeah.
It's a dumpling made from rice flour.
Okay. Is it only a dumpling? Could it be something a little more variety, maybe?
Yeah, there's small dishes served sort of a la carte, and you go to a dim sum, usually, traditionally, like on a Sunday morning, mm-hmm. For brunch, and these ladies wheel around carts.
And they put there.
I want that, and I want that, and I want that. Mm-hmm. You have no idea what they give you because it's mm-hmm. all Chinese.
Right. yeah, one of the restaurants.
Gross and half of it's really good.
Okay. All right. Maybe your definition went a little too far there. One of the restaurants near me, a friend of mine used to work there as a waitress, and she would, they had a style where they would, if they didn't think you were ordering enough, they'd push the cart to make sure it banged into your chair to stimulate your interest in ordering more. But okay, so put it in two words. Small dish, okay. How about tasty morsel, something like that? Anyway, there's small refreshments, and it's very interesting because if you look at the two Chinese characters that make up the word, it literally means something like touching the heart or the mind. The second character means heart or mind, and in Chinese and Japanese, it's basically one word. They don't make a distinction between those two faculties. So heart, mind, and you could translate it either way, or sometimes it's translated as heart / mind. And the first character is probably a verb that means something like touching. So if you look at a dim sum cookbook, they usually translate it as touching the mind or touching the heart. Another interpretation of those characters would be something like a tasty morsel, that the mind, it's not so much the heart or the mind that it's touching, is that you're capturing the essence of what good food would taste like. The reason I'm highlighting this is because the koan case that is commented on here by Dogen deals with a wordplay involving the two Chinese characters. And we'll see how that comes out in a moment. Let me step back now and talk a little bit about Dogen. Some of you are probably aware, and some may not be. Dogen is considered the founder of the Soto sect of Buddhism in Japan in the early 13th century. He traveled to China for several years to study the Zen literature and koan practice, and brought that back to Japan. And I think it's fair to say that Dogen was maybe the first, or certainly one of the first people, to bring back the idea of studying koans and commenting on koans to Japan in the early 1200s. At that time, in China, a vast storehouse of literature involving hundreds of koan cases and other kinds of stories and anecdotes related to Zen masters from the centuries beginning around 700-800 and continuing had built up in China. And especially around the 1000s and 1100s, volumes after volumes were written in Chinese, collecting these stories and commenting on these stories. And there was a certain style that they had developed, and probably you've seen some of that in the translations, where they would cite a koan case. And koan cases are usually fairly short. They can be just a couple lines or no more than a page at the most, usually. And there would be a story of an interaction between a Zen master and a disciple, or a rival Zen master, or some other person that they encountered. And then there'd be a series of comments on that case. And The comments would usually be in the form of a poem. There was a certain kind of stylized Chinese verse that was four lines, a certain number of Chinese characters in the four lines. And then you'd have that kind of comment, and then you'd have some prose comments, and then you'd have what's called the capping phrase, where they'd make an ironic and sometimes sarcastic comment on the significance of it. And they'd also often would cite some of the biographical background of the Zen master that was involved in the koan, and tell some other stories about their life and their teachings to give a little context. Dogen must have studied this and absorbed it, but when he came to back to Japan and was trying to introduce this material to the Japanese context, my understanding of it is that he kind of faced a turning point, and was he going to do the Chinese style or was he going to create his own style? And that's what he did. He did a different style of commentary on the koans than what you would see in the Chinese koan collections, for better or worse. I mean, most of us think it's for better. And one of the things that he tried to do was to change the meaning and the significance of the koans from the conventional interpretation, and give a certain creative flair and a unique interpretation, and show that the koans could be open up to a variety of implications. So what Dogen did is what I would call critical commentary. By critical here, I mean that he would not take for granted the traditional commentary that he had come across in studying the Chinese materials, but he wanted to introduce it, but introduce it in a way that showed his unique style of interpretation and the way he wanted to see it done. So let me give a couple of other examples of koans that Dogen changes from the conventional interpretation and adds his distinctive impression, and that sets a little bit of background. Then we'll look at this particular case involving the dim sum. And afterwards, we're going to serve some dim sum? Is that the...
some tea and cookies, or some okay. kind of... refreshment,
and that's the way it sometimes is translated. And here it's also referred to as rice cake, because rice cake would be one of the main examples of a kind of small refreshment that they would have served. So let me give two other examples. One is a famous case called skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, and this is when the creator of Zen Buddhism, Bodhidharma, was trying to select his second patriarch, or the patriarch that would succeed him. And according to one of the main versions of that, he interviewed four disciples, and the first three gave some kind of oral presentation. In other words, they said a couple of sentences about the significance of the Buddha's teaching. And they were not the winner of the award, so to speak, or they did not become the second patriarch. They were given respectively the skin, flesh, bones, and the second patriarch, who attained the marrow, or the apparently the deepest level, and represented the pinnacle of understanding, kept silent. And so according to the conventional interpretation of that koan case, silence prevails over speech, and there's kind of a gradation or a hierarchy or a depth of understanding that can go from the skin to the marrow. One of the interesting things, if you look at that koan case historically, and you look at the way the Zen literature developed in China, you see that there were a lot of different versions of it before the version that we usually are reading today in the translations. In some versions, there were only three rather than four disciples. In some versions, they went in a different order in terms of the answers that were given. In some cases, they didn't have much of a dialogue. At all. In fact, they were all silent, and it was more a question of the body language in terms of who won the award. Dogen probably was exposed to that, and he realized that there's a lot of different possibilities, and he's going to come up with one more possibility. And in his interpretation, which is contained in a chapter of the Shobogenzo called Kato, or Tangled Vines, he says that... that the person was silent did not represent a deeper understanding, that all four disciples had the same depth of understanding, and that they were all correct in their own way. So I think the bottom line there is that Dogen is making a statement to say that language is just as valid as silence, And we see this ringing true in other kinds of writings and expressions by Dogen, who did not want to apparently overemphasize that silence was the ultimate expression or non-expression of truth. And he's critical of other Zen masters that of that era who emphasize silence too much, he feels, and he's trying to talk about the importance of rhetoric and discourse in expressing the Dharma. So that's a prominent case where he changes the conventional interpretation at the time. And then there's another case where of a koan known as Mazu polishing and Mazu and polishing the brick. And there was a famous Zen master in the 8th century in China who was one of the leaders, and he was a couple generations before the famous monk Rinzai, who was practicing meditation. And he was asked, "Why are you practicing meditation?" And he said, "In order to become a Buddha." And the response was, "Well, that's like polishing a brick to make a mirror." The conventional reading of that would be to say that meditation is secondary to sudden enlightenment, that sudden enlightenment transcends the practice of meditation. And we know that the debates between the sudden school and the gradual school were very fierce in the early period of Zen in China. And this seems to be making a statement on the side of the sudden school. And the idea is that you can't make a mirror simply by polishing the brick. It's never going to happen that way, and therefore you can't necessarily become a Buddha by practicing meditation. But Dogen looks at that, and we know that he does strongly favor sitting meditation, and he talks about the doctrine of Shikantaza, or just sitting, and just sitting with objectless meditation is the key to enlightenment. And he's trying to look for a kind of a compromise between sudden and gradual. He doesn't like those polarities, and he doesn't like debating one extreme versus the other, but trying to find the middle way. And so when he interprets the koan, he rewrites it a little bit, and he says that when this has happened, it's not before Mazu's enlightenment experience, but Mazu was already enlightened when he has this experience, so that the comment was not to criticize him that polishing a brick to become a mirror implies that, you know, this is not a possibility, it's not realistic, it's not going to happen. But in fact, the polishing a brick to make a mirror does reflect Mazu's enlightenment, and he goes on to say, if you do polish that brick enough, you can see your reflection in it, and it's just as good as a mirror, and therefore you should meditate constantly as the key to the experience. So Dogen, once again, takes license with the traditional interpretation and changes his wording a little bit in this case, and plays with the different levels of significance of it to make his point. And that's what he's going to do in the passage that we're going to read now. So let me ask you to look at the first paragraph, and I'll just sum that up briefly. And it refers to the monk Toksan, who was a famous monk from that early period. By the early period, we mean in the 700s and 800s in China, when Zen was becoming firmly established as an important school of thought and practice in China. And Toksan was known for having gone through a kind of conversion experience because he favored the sutras, and he was supposed to be the king of the Diamond Sutra. And he had built up a set of commentaries on the Diamond Sutra. And we know that Zen looks upon the sutras as secondary, because what's primary is practice and meditation rather than studying the sutra. And so Toksan is going to get his comeuppance in a couple of examples of stories. But he goes on to become a great master. So the stories about Toksan and some of the others, like Rinzai and some of the other famous masters, are always a little bit ambiguous, because sometimes they do things that are fallible and they get criticized a little bit, and then that helps to build up their wisdom, and it's kind of a way of polishing the brick, so to speak, until they perfect their understanding. But in this story, Toksan is going to get his comeuppance, and he's going to suffer at the hands of a lay woman who is on the side of the road selling rice cakes. And let me mention that this is not the only example where a woman outsmarts a male and a lay person outsmarts a monastic. And there are a couple of koans that preserve stories like that. There's a famous one where Zhaozhou or Joshu, another famous monk from that era, is outsmarted by a lay, an elderly lay woman that he meets on the side of the road. So that's kind of a theme that in a number of the Zen anecdotes from that period. So the second paragraph that we have here is very important because this captures the heart of the story. So I'd like to see if we could you know, read through that. And Meg, Taigen, who would be a good person, do you think, to, or maybe you yourself?
Kevin, would you read it for us?
Sure. He had stopped to catch his breath by the side of the road that led to Master Rutan's temple when an old woman came by. Toku-san asked her who she was. The old woman replied, "I am an old woman who sells rice cakes." Toku-san asked her, "Will you sell me some rice cakes?" The old woman said, "Revered monk, why would you want to buy them?" Toku-san replied, "I would buy your rice cakes so that I might refresh my mind." The old woman remarked, "Revered monk, that load you're carrying with you is really something." Toku-san replied, "Have you not heard of me? I am the fully perfected lord of the diamond cutting scripture. I have so mastered this scripture that there is nothing in it that I do not understand. What I am carrying with me are my commentaries on the diamond cutting scripture." Upon hearing them say this, the old woman asked, "Revered monk, would you permit an old woman like me to put a question to you?" Toku-san replied, "Yes. Ask whatever you may wish." She said, "I once heard the part in the diamond cutting scripture where it says, 'The mind of the past cannot be held unto, the mind of the present cannot be held unto, the mind of the future cannot be held unto.' Which mind do you think you are going to refresh with these rice cakes? If the revered monk is able to say, I will sell him some rice cakes. If the revered monk is unable to say, I will not sell him any rice cakes." Toku-san, at this moment, was so flabbergasted that he could not recall how he would have customarily responded, whereupon the old woman dismissed him with a flick of her wrist and left without selling Toku-san any of her rice cakes.
All right, so poor Toku-san gets no rice cake. No rice cakes for you, Toku-san. Does everybody see how this is related back to the two Chinese characters? What she's doing basically is making a play on those words. So in asking for rice cakes, you're asking for the idea of pointing to the mind. And it's not clear whether the typical Chinese person at that time would have thought about that wordplay, or this was something very unique to this particular koan case. But it is an ingenious device that touches base with a key passage in the Diamond Sutra concerning the past, present, and future minds being ungraspable. So if we take this story at face value before we get to see Dogen's interpretation of it and how he's going to change around a little bit, how could we sum up the story so far? What's the message of the story? What's the moral of it so far? Remember, Dogen doesn't like silence, so...
Being a sutra master isn't good enough.
Okay, being a sutra master isn't good enough. Good. So I think that's definitely the starting point. What's wrong with being a sutra master?
I think the traditional position would be it's just words and letters, and the important thing is wordless experience.
Okay, so it's intellectual knowledge without experiential wisdom, let's say. It's reading words and letters on a page. It's building up commentaries on words and letters without the wisdom that is supposed to underlie that. Okay, so anything else? What can we say about that issue? Similar to the skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, is this the same message pretty much so far? Of the conventional understanding of that passage?
Yeah,
So in other words, being a master of the sutra is not enough. And so, and what else can we say next after that? What's the truth that they're pointing to?
Just discussing them some can refresh your mind.
Okay, so discussing it can or can't refresh your mind?
Well, in a way, I think his mind was refreshed, all three, by
all three meaning past, present, future?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just by being refused the rice cake, because he thought he was, he kind of thought that he was loaded with information and, you know, in a way he was full. And then she kind of challenged that and refreshed his mind for him.
Okay. All right. That I like the way you're putting that. Let's work through that a little bit more. So he comes with this assumption of fullness because of his understanding based on the sutra. That fullness that he thinks he has is really, it's going to be exposed to be empty. It's a false sense of fullness. That it's a fullness that's accompanied by arrogance and a presumptiveness that he has the truth in his back pocket. You know, there's a strong message here about you can learn a lesson from a non-specialist. You can find a quote-unquote ordinary layperson who can use words and letters more inventively than the supposed specialist and expert on it. It's moving us away from those false levels of understanding. Now, according to what you said, Toksan himself is, Toksan is refreshed. Okay. Does he seem refreshed at the end of this passage?
Not yet.
Not yet, perhaps. In other words, at the end of this passage, do we know exactly how he's, you know, what he's thinking?
Well, maybe that he was flabbergasted and he was refreshed because he was so full of himself, and she kind of emptied him. She deflated him mm-hmm. a little bit, and so that seems like a new. That seems kind of refreshing.
Okay, so he's defreshed. we might assume he's refreshed because once he's emptied out his arrogance and false understanding, the door is left open for him to have a kind of renewal. But the literal words on the page here don't quite take us to that point. And so leaves off with his comeuppance, and we assume something better is going to happen for him, but we don't quite know. And that's the opening where Dogen's going to come in and give his unique reading. But before we get to that, let's turn to the passage on the bottom of the other page, Blue Cliff Record, case number 4. Now, if you look at a translation of the Blue Cliff Record, which has 100 cases, this case will be number 4. And the way the Blue Cliff Record works, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, it was one of the koan commentaries that had the poems, it had the capping phrases, and it also had a rather lengthy narrative, usually, for each case, in which they give a little bit of the background of the Zen master who's the main part of the case. The story of the rice cake selling is actually inserted into the prose commentary of Blue Cliff Record case number 4. You don't usually see that story as an independent koan. The reason I mention that is because it shows that Dogen, who had studied this vast material, picked up on a very fine detail that, okay, this is a little story in the background of the background of this other case, but I want to highlight that and I'm going to write a whole chapter about that case. So once again, the rice cake anecdote comes as part of the commentary in the Blue Cliff Record. case number four. So let's look at Blue Cliff Record case number four, which is another story about Toksan. We get a different sense of what Toksan is like from that case. So could we get someone to read or be assigned to read this one?
Douglas, please.
Toksan arrived at Isan. Carrying his bundle under his arm, he stepped into the Dharma Hall. He walked across it from east to west and from west to east. Looking around, he said, "None, none," and you have. Sitchuk commented, "Soon through." But when he got to the entrance gate, Toksan said, "Still, I shouldn't be so hasty." So he dressed formally and entered again to meet Isan. As Isan sat at his place, Toksan held up his sitting cloth in a ceremonial manner and said, "Master!" Isan was about to take his whisk when suddenly Tokusu shouted, "Cuts!" Then he flourished his sleeves and went out. Setsu commented, "Seen through." Turning his back on the Dharma Hall, Toksan put on his straw sandals and left. In the evening, Isan asked the head monk, "Where's the newcomer who was here a while ago?" The head monk said, "He soon turned his back on the Dharma Hall, put on his straw sandals and went away." Isan said, "One day that fellow will build a grass hut upon a lonely peak and scold the Buddhas and abuse the patriarchs." Setsu commented, "Piling up frost on double snow."
Okay, great. Thank you. So, based on this passage, what kind of impression do we get about Toksan? Well, before we get to that question, let me sum up what's happened here. So, Toksan is visiting a famous Zen master, Isan. The implication is that Toksan is more of a novice. He's at a junior level. He's trying to find a teacher. We don't quite know why he's visiting Isan, but Isan is an established master and Toksan is an itinerant. That's kind of clear from the structure of the story. Toksan is traveling. He's carrying his bundle, so he's not staying permanently at this monastery. He enters into the Dharma Hall, which would have been the main hall and where the formal Dharma discourses would have been taking place. He walks across it from east to west and from west to east, and he said, "None, none," and goes out. But then we find out that Isan has probably been sitting there all along. So when you read the second paragraph and you go back to the first paragraph, you realize that Toksan has been rather a brash fellow in the sense that he paraded around the Dharma Hall of an established master and says, "None, none," implying that there's nothing I can learn here. Once again, we see the arrogance that he's had in the case with the old woman when he's carried the when he claims to be the king of the Diamond Sutra. So then we have the interaction between Toksan and Isan. Apparently, he thinks better of leaving so hastily, and he goes back to encounter Isan. Isan sits in his place, and Toksan calls out, "Master," and Isan takes up the ceremonial fly whisk, and Toksan shouts and flourishes his sleeves and goes out. So what do we say about that encounter between the two? What's happening with Toksan here? Yeah.
It's not an encounter. Isan has no part of it. It's Toksan coming.
Isan has no verbal part of it. That's definitely true. He doesn't say anything. But let's one way to look at it. Who's the winner and who's the loser?
Well, Toksan's got all the action, so I would say he's the winner.
He's the
winner.
Okay, he's got the action. He comes and he pays his respects, and when he doesn't get the satisfactory answer, he leaves. One interesting point is that the phrase at the end of that paragraph, "he flourished his sleeves," is something that you see in a lot of Chinese poetry from that era, especially romantic poetry, and it usually has to do with a jilted romantic partner, a jilted lover, kind of getting upset and walking off, and they use that phrase about shaking their sleeves as they walk off to show their dissatisfaction with the situation. And it's interesting how that enters into the rhetoric of the koan story here in a different context, but it's still similar in the sense of showing displeasure. And Toksan gets to do that. In the final paragraph, how does Isan respond? In other words, Isan's comment on Toksan, is it favorable or unfavorable?
Favorable.
Favorable, right?
He acknowledges his risk.
He acknowledges that Toksan has shown him something. And he says that he'll scold the Buddhas and abuse the patriarchs. One of the ironic Zen sayings that Toksan's going to be able to teach some of the old masters. So in this story, then, we can sum up that Toksan has started out as the arrogant guy that we saw in the story about the rice cake. But his arrogance really has worked on his behalf in this case. In this case, he's been able to assert himself towards Isan, and Isan is willing to acknowledge that that Toksan has demonstrated his own level of mastery. And one of the qualities that we see is that the teacher is not on his own ego trip, so he's willing to give credit where credit is due. And if Toksan has come in and shown Isan something, Isan's not going to base his response on the formality and the sense of etiquette and courtesy alone, even though that is an important feature of a Dharma hall and of a Zen monastic institution. To have that kind of structure is very important. To know your place in a Zen monastic structure is certainly a key to how the institution works to some extent. But we know that in Zen, the institution also leaves room for something that can be called anti-structural, or the creative genius that reflects a kind of inspiration, and you can break the rules if you're doing that appropriately to demonstrate wisdom. So we get a little bit better impression of Toksan here than in the case of the old woman. Now, there's no strict chronology when you look at these different stories about which happened first and which happened later. But the assumption would be that Toksan has not become a master yet in either story. And he's proving himself, and he's learning along the way. Okay, so Dogen, taking in these various stories, then comes back to the rice cake story. And here's where Dogen's going to make his case known. And I think that what we can say is that what Dogen does in the top paragraph on that second page is a little bit similar to what Toksan himself does in the anecdote with Isan, in the sense that Dogen's going to use his creativity to break through and to kind of show that the traditional patriarchs don't have all the answers. Just like Toksan's going to stand up to Isan, Dogen here is going to stand up to the conventional interpretations of the rice cake story and interpret it a little bit differently. So how about, can we read this paragraph?
More on?
Okay. Thank you.
Someone offer. Please.
Yeah.
Okay. Which the top one?
I guess it starts on the bottom in the Great Song of China.
Oh, sorry. All right. In Great Song of China today, among the novices garbed in their patched robes and broad sleeves of monks, there are those who laugh at Toksan's inability to respond appropriately and who esteem what they take to be the old woman's sharp whip. This is something that is surely quite pitiful and befuddled, since there are reasons for us to have doubts about the old woman. For instance, at the very moment when Toksan was unable to speak, the old woman could have turned to him and said, "The reverend monk is unable to respond now, so she should go on and put the question to this old woman, and she, in response, will say something for the reverend monk's benefit." By speaking in this manner, it would be evident that the old woman was what we call such a person,
if, in response to Tokusan's question, she spoke true. Even though she had a question for him, she had not yet expressed the matter herself. Ever since ancient times, no one has been called such a person who has not uttered at least a single word to express it. We can see from Tokusan's past that there is no benefit in constantly bragging about oneself. We can realize by means of the old woman that a person who has not yet expressed it cannot be acknowledged as having realized the truth. As an experiment, let us say something in Tokusan's stead. Were the old woman really posing her question from that frame of mind, Tokusan might have said to her, "If you are in that frame of mind, do not sell me any rice cakes."
Okay. All right. So there are a couple of expressions that they use here. For example, such a person. And there's an important idea in Mahayana Buddhism of that's often translated as thusness or suchness. Suchness meaning a grasp of fundamental wisdom. And so when they're referring to such a person, the implication is that this is a person who has the transcendental knowledge and therefore is a truth speaker. And if the woman selling the rice cakes is given as much credit as most of the interpreters have given her, then she is such a person, and we have to put her in that elevated category. And Dogen's going to question that. So he's going to try to knock her down a rung or two on the ladder, and he's also going to give Tokusan an opportunity to come into the picture. The way this translation renders some of the passage around the middle of that paragraph, they refer to the matter in capital letters, and then they also refer to expressing it with a capital I, the line below that. And so I think we could take such and matter and it and translate those as truth with a capital T. And the question is, does she really express this or not? Now, it's interesting, if we go back to the top line on that page, Dogen's referring to the teachers of the great Song China today, and Song was the name of the dynasty of Chinese history that was happening at Dogen's era. That was the period when Dogen went to China for a few years before he became a teacher. And the Song dynasty went from the late 900s to the late 1200s, when it was succeeded by the Yuan dynasty, which was the Mongol empire period in Chinese history. Those 300 years or so of Song China were the peak period of Zen literature and koans being written. So when Dogen is saying that in Great Song China, that the people are pitiful and befuddled, you know, he's taking quite a strong stand there. Again, I would compare that to what Tokusan himself did in going into Isan's temple, with Isan sitting there in his high seat and saying nothing to learn here, basically. But that's the Zen style. The new disciple coming on strong is supposed to stand up and show his stuff in front of the established teachers, and they are there to do their best to acknowledge the new truth speakers as they come forth. So, so in this paragraph, Dogen has implied that something may be wrong, something's missing with the old woman selling the rice cake. You wouldn't know that, you wouldn't necessarily think that if you just stick with the original anecdote, but Dogen's going to try to read through that anecdote and find a new twist. So if we go with the logic of what Dogen's saying, in his interpretation, what is wrong with the old woman? What is missing? On what basis could we question or challenge her understanding?
Well, according to Dogen, she did not give an expression of capital T truth.
Right. Good. Okay. So what did she do then?
Well, that's the odd thing, because, I mean, she flicked her wrist.
Mm-hmm.
In the other story,
he shook his
sleeves.
Yeah. One is an expression, and one isn't. So it's kind of odd.
Yeah. So she was able to tweak him in that story. She was able to, what was it, defresh him or refresh him? But that's the question. Did she refresh him or not? We go back to that point. She's undercut him. She's undermined him. She's questioned him. She's forced Toksan in the original story to see some of his own limitations. But does it stop there? She's challenged and exposed the problem in Toksan, but has she put forth positively her own sense, her own expression? According to Dogen, that's a little bit questionable. We don't know for sure. And to elevate her to this high category, okay, she's you know, the implication in the original story is that she's somebody who can revile the patriarchs and scold the Buddhas. He's not so sure that she's ready to be given that status. Now, on a sidebar here, Dogen's view on gender issues was rather complicated, because Dogen was known for making, in some passages, a very strong statement for the equality of women, and women can attain enlightenment. And in other aspects of Dogen's life and teaching, it seems like he took a little bit more conservative stance, and he wasn't making a point of gender equality. And here we have a woman outsmarting a man, and then Dogen's going to come along and say, well, maybe she wasn't so great herself. From a contemporary gender issue standpoint, we might wonder why he is, you know, is that part of the motive for his questioning? I'm not saying it is or it isn't, but it's just a thought that could come out. Okay, so we're left at the end of this paragraph with the idea that that Toksan is going to come back and not leave the dialogue at the point it originally was, where he's simply flabbergasted and he has nothing to say and he's rendered speechless, but he's going to come back and challenge her, because he can see there's an opening there, and maybe she's not as great as she seems to be. Just, you know, maybe she has some of the same arrogance in her wordplay that he had in asserting his superiority with the Diamond Sutra. He's the king of the Diamond Sutra. She's the king of the dim sum wordplay. But who's really got the wisdom? Dogen's going to leave that contest still up for grabs. So let's go to the next paragraph, please.
Had Toksan spoken in this way, he might have been someone of sharp wit who had learned something through the practice of spiritual training. Toksan might have asked the old woman, "When the mind of the past cannot be retained, the mind of the present cannot be held onto, the mind of the future cannot be grasped, so which mind do you propose to refresh with your rice cakes?" Were she asked in this way, then she might have responded to Toksan by saying, "If the reverend monk only knows that rice cakes do not refresh the mind, then he does not know that mind refreshes the rice cakes, or that mind refreshes the mind."
Okay, good. And thank you for that reading. And I think this is maybe the most important passage in the chapter. If the reverend monk only knows that rice cakes do not refresh the mind, here we get the refresh idea, then he does not know that the mind refreshes the rice cakes, or that mind refreshes the mind. Okay, so Dogen himself is going to add to the wordplay by emphasizing the mind refreshing, or the mind turning. So if we go back to the meaning of dim sum, it's something like touching the heart or mind, or turning the mind, or pointing to the mind. It's those are the ways, some of the ways that it's translated. But then he's going to invert it a little bit and talk, instead of talking about pointing to the mind or touching the mind, he's going to say the mind is touching. He's going to make a grammatical twist there. And he's going to take a little bit of poetic license, and part of that has to do with the transition from citing the Japanese the original Chinese and the Japanese grammatical context, and he's speaking to an audience of monks in Japan who probably didn't know Chinese as well as he did, so he's got a lot of leeway here to play with the words a little bit more than the Chinese might have done, where they're kind of confined by the literary styles of the period. But let's consider that passage. The mind refreshes the rice cakes, or that mind refreshes the mind. What would be the message of that passage? The mind refreshes the mind.
The mind of past, present, and future are the small mind, are the mind of an individual as he or she just goes through a whole set of phases.
Mm-hmm.
The capital letter seems to refer to large mind, Buddha mind,
mm-hmm.
which exists outside of past, present, and future.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So there would be a distinction between the everyday mind that can be segmented into past, present, and future, and it can be segmented sequentially, and is the mind of polarities and bifurcations and dichotomies and either or mind, and the mind interpreted here, of course, capitalizing is an English device, is a device in the English translation to get the point across, but the implication is that there's another level of mind, a universal mind, a comprehensive mind, that is beyond the sequence of past, present, and future, but yet encompasses it at the same time. So, let's come back to that passage, because I think that's really crucial. Let's jump ahead to the final paragraph, and we're running out of time, so let me just highlight a couple of key passages here. It says that Dokusan would have had a doubt arise. And then it says that the woman might take one of the rice, around the middle, fourth or fifth line, may take one of the rice cakes and hit him and say, "You gutless wonder, don't be such a ninny." And Dokusan would respond again and back and forth. And he concludes, "The old woman's and Toksan's questions and answers concerning the mind of the past and the mind of the future are merely their mind of the present being unable to grasp it." Again, we get back to the capital letters in the English translation. So who does Dogen end up liking or disliking in this passage?
Neither.
Yeah. Neither. Okay. So let's go back, sum up the bottom line. What is his message, and how does that relate to the passage about the mind refreshing the mind? Yeah.
Thinking about this story as opposed to the other with Isan, seems like there's a challenge. And in the case of the old woman, neither the challenger nor the person challenged rises to the occasion.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the case of Tokusan and Isan, Tokusan issues a challenge and Isan does his part, mm-hmm. which is to realize it and give it its full value.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of they both rise to the occasion. They both come out of it.
Yeah. Itself. Right. Okay. So in the Toksan Isan, they're both rising to the occasion, and that's the way the tradition puts it forward. Isan rises to the occasion that he's not egotistical and he's able to acknowledge what Toksan has accomplished. Here, Dogen wants to put them both in their place, and neither one has risen to the challenge according to his understanding. And I think you find that quite a bit. In fact, in the incredible translation of Dogen's other main writing, Eihei Koloku, in the book that Taigen Leighton did with Shohaku Okamura, Dogen's extended record, what you often see is passages where Dogen cites a variety of other masters, including his own teacher, Ru Jing, who enlightened him when he was in China. And he'll say, well, this master says it this way, and that master says it that way, and even my own teacher, Ru Jing, said it this way, and guess what? I don't agree with any of them, and I'm going to say it my way, and then he'll take the fly whisk and throw it down or draw a circle in the air or make some bold statement. So I think there's something about Dogen wanting to keep that brash quality that we see in a lot of the stories and didn't want to see himself as just an old fogey, so to speak. So let's go back. Mind refreshes mind. Once he's critical of everybody, he's leaving us kind of with this negativity there. We know what's wrong with them, but what does he want to, what positive message does he want to put forward? I think it's the key to this is mind refreshes mind. And how could we capture the significance of that?
Back to the original, that original text, I still think it's that gap that was created by that woman that refreshed his mind, but I think that it didn't matter whether she was that type of person or not. It could happen from any experience in like a, you know, just a, just sort of by happen chance, and there's this opportunity.
Okay.
For your mind to be refreshed through just a small coincidence.
I like that. In other words, I think Dogen's point is it doesn't matter what the particular words are. He's got the Diamond Sutra, she's got the wordplay, nothing is sufficient in itself to capture the answer. And yet at the same time, every single area of discourse and every verbal exchange is an opportunity, no matter how small the thing that you're dealing with. Just that piece of rice cake is an opportunity to gain a breakthrough understanding, to have a kind of Satori experience. So it doesn't matter what the particular words are. I think that's why he's trying to break it down. The mind refreshes mind means, to me, that if you have that mind, if you are such a person, then anything and everything that you say is going to be touched or reflected by it. So in that sense, they're both wrong, but in at the same time, I think his implication is that they're all right. They're both right. And that the wordplay and the exchange back and forth and the continuing involvement is what makes it so fascinating. Don't just stop there. Skin, flesh, bones, marrow. Don't just stop with marrow and say, that's it, because then you're going to reify something and you're going to prevent opportunities from coming up. What he wants to do is create more and more opportunities. So everything is an opportunity. That's the way I see it. I think that's what you captured in your explanation of it. So,
also,
yes.
It seems like he wants the dialogue to keep going.
Yeah, the dialogue.
The convention would have been, she would have asked him, which mind are you going to refresh? He wouldn't have been able to answer the Blue Cliff Record or Umankan.
Yeah.
Then she would have either shouted or she would have handed him a rice cake.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been the end of it.
Yeah.
Dogen's not suggesting that. He says, let's have a... keep going.
That's it, right, exactly. Don't just put the end of it. Let's keep it going and let's see where it leads. So he's playing out a number of possibilities and you know, I think the inspiration for us 800 years later is that we can keep that alive by continuing to the dialogue.
I'm struck by that same line, but the other half almost, or the two halves together about the fine refreshing rice cakes.
Mm-hmm.
And then following that up with mind refreshes the mind, it seems so classically Dogen,
mm-hmm.
doing that thing that he does that's so subtle, you know? It seems mm-hmm. like that's the thing that he introduced and that he's promoting here,
mm-hmm.
is this greater deftness and subtlety.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he does that by saying mind refreshes the rice cakes, like that's this flip that he always does,
yeah.
linguistically and conceptually. And then, but he does it there, then he does it again.
Yeah.
And he flips it again.
And he flips it. Yeah, he flips it a couple times in that same sentence. Yeah.
And it's just like he does that so often.
Mm-hmm.
That's the beauty about reading.
Yeah, yeah. And just about every chapter of Shobo Genzo, there's going to be several examples where he does that linguistic conceptual flip. So for people that maybe haven't had a chance to read Dogen as much, what he keeps wanting to say is that spark of inspiration comes in and you look at things from all angles, you turn them around. As soon as you get satisfied that this that there's an either-or black and white interpretation, then you're just as stuck as Toksan holding the Diamond Sutra or coming into the temple with the bundle. You know, Toksan has his baggage in the contemporary sense of that term with his Diamond Sutra and his bundle. He's got to abandon that baggage, and the way to do that is to look at the words from every angle. So no reliance on words and letters is the typical Zen motto, but for Dogen, the no reliance doesn't mean you abandon them. It just means they're not fixed in one particular place, but you continue to use the words and letters in an unfixed way, and that's the flip, I think, that you're referring to.
Yeah.